Welcome to the PoliticalBetting.com Polling Matters podcast. My name is Kieran Pedley. It's been a big week in US politics, with the death of Supreme Court Justice Scalia casting a long shadow over the race. Now President Obama has to nominate a successor, but he may well find it very difficult to get that through the Senate, especially considering that Senators Ted Cruz and Marco Rubio are vying for the Republican nomination and will want to be seen as leading the charge against him. Meanwhile, in South Carolina, former President George W. Bush has been on the stump campaigning for his little brother. But is the Bush legacy a help or a hindrance when we consider 2016? Earlier on today, I spoke to John Christopher Buer, White House correspondent and political analyst, formerly of Sky News in the UK, who has interviewed many of these candidates and will therefore have a unique insight into the race and what we should be looking out for in the future. Later in the episode, I'll be talking to Leo Barassi about events closer to home. For example, the EU. What is the state of the EU referendum campaign? And as we enter our own electoral season in May, what is the state of the political parties in Westminster? But first, we'll look back today to my interview with John Christopher Buer, and we started off by asking him what impact he thought the death of Justice Scalia would have on the presidential race. John Christopher Buer, thank you for joining me.
My pleasure, Kieran. Happy to be with you.
So obviously lots to talk about in the coming 10 minutes or so that we have you. First of all, looking at the death of Antonin Scalia, I mean, how significant do you see that being in this presidential race? On the one hand, the public may not pay too much attention as to who's on the Supreme Court in their day-to-day lives, but it is election year, isn't it?
Well, there are three branches of government that the founders wisely put together when this country began, and the branches are called the executive, legislative, and judiciary, which is the courts. And it was the founders intended those to be separate. I think to answer your question right off the bat, I think the passing of Justice Scalia is monumental in terms of this campaign. It really changed everything around in one unfortunate event with his passing on Saturday. And I think the president made very clear against opposition from the opposition from the Republicans, that he will, in fact, place the nomination of another potential justice, as soon as he finds the right one, which there is a process, and he will put it out there. The most significant decision a president can make, which will have a lasting impact not only on his or her legacy and the direction of the country, but it could be possibly the direction of the world. There are so many things pending. There are so many laws and issues that are being held up at the moment, because now there are four and four, which means four progressives, liberals, however you want to call them, Democratic types, and four Republicans, conservatives, however you want to call them, on the other side of the aisle. And those were appointed by presidents who were Republicans, who were Democrats, and they're there. And this appointment goes way beyond Barack Obama's tenure in the White House, and could go way beyond his lifetime. A young enough Supreme Court justice could live to be 80 or 90 years old, and if you appoint someone who's 40 or 50 years old, you can just see how long that will go. And it happens.
And as we know, the Republicans obviously control the Senate at present, and that may or may not change in November. And there are two Republican senators that are vying for the nomination at the moment, Marco Rubio and Ted Cruz, of course. How do you see them playing this? Because obviously, you know, being in the Senate, you know, do they lead to the charge against Obama's nominee, or do they try and act, you know, in a statesmanlike manner? I mean, you know, Ted Cruz seems to be the guy that wants to lead the charge against the president, maybe filibuster, as he has done before. But how do you see each candidate playing this role, and maybe some of the others too?
Well, you forgot the crusader in chief, Mr. Trump, who is leading this charge with his lovely flag of St. George basically on him, with white shirt with a red tie. He looks like he's off fighting dragons. The fact is that Trump is the one who is really opposing Obama's nomination of a justice. And then, of course, you're right, Cruz and Rubio, who are, by the way, Karen, vying for the second spot. Trump has got he's way ahead in every poll, including the national polls. So what the battle royal now is between Cruz and Rubio to get that spot when they think Trump will eventually kind of disintegrate on his own, fall on his own petard or his big mouth or whatever one hopes who was in opposition to Mr. Trump. So they are all going after it. Even John Kasich said it should be held off until there's a Republican president. There is no precedent in this country where a president who in his last term of last year in office cannot nominate and for to present to the Senate for advisory consent. There's a great movie about that, by the way. You should Google it. And that is the right of the president of the United States. Obama was elected to a second term of 4 years, not 3 years, and he has 10 more months left to fulfill that obligation, which is his obligation, to nominate a Supreme Court justice.
But then to play devil's advocate, the Republicans will say, well, hang on a minute, there was a midterm election. The people returned a Republican Senate, of course, only a third of it being up. And the Republicans are perfectly entitled to veto or vote down the president's choice.
Well, they can do whatever they want, but they can't prevent the president from making his nomination, and they must vote on it. It must come out. You know, the leadership has said no. Mitch McConnell said, don't do it. But other very, very wise and also prudent senators have said, well, wait a second. Senator Grassley, who's the judiciary chairman of the Senate Judiciary Committee, said, no, well, wait a second. We can't just say we're not going to take any recommendation or any nomination and filibuster it or put it away, not even hear it. And guess why, Karen? He is up for election. It is very, very, very clear to many of the Republicans that they don't want to seem to their constituents to be, once again, as an obstructionist, nor do many other senators who are now coming along saying, well, wait a minute, let's get this nomination in. We can vote on him, whether him or her, whether we like them or not, but let's not look to our constituents like we're obstructionists, like we're putting a monkey wrench into the system. People are very unhappy with Obama. They think he has not done his job. They don't think government is run correctly, smoothly. And that's why I said earlier, and you can bring it back in if you like, that they're looking at alternatives like Trump, and they're looking at alternatives back on track, like Sanders, because they're sick of the status quo. They are sick of things not working, and these two individuals are offering them alternative. And Trump is the most outspoken in terms of crushing government, and he's never held a political job in his life. Mm. He's a great master of stagecraft, and he's got a big mouth, and he's from Queens, New York, just like me. So I know these kinds of guys. By the way, Justice Scalia was from Queens, New York, and both Governors Cuomo were from Queens, New York. Tony Bennett is from Queens, New York. And we guys have this certain kind of air about us, a bit arrogant, a bit wise, and Trump is using that to his benefit. And there will always be a group of 20 to 30% people who will be with Trump no matter what to the end.
I mean, look at one person we haven't spoken to about recently is Jeb Bush, of course, and he had Big Brother out campaigning on the stump for him in South Carolina. I'm interested in what your thoughts are on that. I mean, George W. Bush has, President Bush has obviously stayed on the margins, not really got too involved in the political process since leaving office, but obviously is now campaigning for his brother, as you might expect. But do you think the Bush legacy or the Bush dynasty, if you like, it could be a benefit for Jeb Bush, or do you think actually it could be a hindrance?
It's a really good question, and people have been asking me. I do commentary for Euronews, and I was on LBC, I think, yesterday. And the Bush concept is very interesting because most people in Europe certainly know who George W. Bush was. They know who Joe H.W. Bush was, and they are wondering, is this guy going to follow in the path of those two presidents who some say, we're quite good, and some think we're quite failed. But I have to tell you, on a personal level, I was never a big George Bush fan. However, when I saw him come out to support his brother, I got a tinge of nostalgia. I mean, I said, there he is. This is a guy. He's what they call here a man's man. No nonsense. He looked you straight in the eye. He swaggers out there. He's got a sharp tongue. And some of us miss that. And some of us miss that because he was a no-nonsense guy, right or wrong. But the problem for Jeb is, it's really a double-edged sword. The stronger his brother looks, the weaker Jeb looks. And people say, gee, I wish we had that Bush back. Because Jeb, he doesn't have the fire in the belly. No matter what George Bush did, W, that is, and I knew many people who worked with him, members of Congress and the Senate, and they'd sit there in the conference room in the White House, and they'd say, this guy, he's a real guy. he talks to you straightforwardly. He's a no nonsense guy, and people like that. And he believed in his convictions, even if they were harebrained. And the fact is that Jeb does not have that kind of commitment, that kind of fire in the belly, and it's hurting him. Although I will say, in many of the polls, since W, as you say, W, came out to support Jeb, his numbers went up a little bit. But he's not a player. This will not happen. He needs to survive South Carolina. Now, South Carolina always liked the Bushes. Barbara Bush, his mom, actually went to school there. So there's a real love relationship with the Palmetto State and the Bushes. So, however, that's not going to save him. He's not going to win. He's not probably won't win any. But it's an interesting thing. In the very beginning, and I write a lot of blog commentary for Huffington Post UK, I had initially put, about a year ago, I put Hillary and Jeb together. And I said, how can these two dynasties, who actually many of the family members like each other, George H.W. Bush and Bill Clinton do work together, international work together, they've seen together. And I think that the problem is that he seemed to be the one. It was the Bush family, the Jeb Bush. He had a great background. He had great support. He had the kinds of staffing that his father had. And that was, people were thinking, this is going to be a president. But he didn't come through with that. He doesn't have that kind of feeling. And years ago when I was studying acting, I had a teacher who said to me, you know, you can't teach charisma. You can teach technique, you can teach speech, you can teach elocution, better say that correctly, but you can't teach somebody how to have that kind of dynamic or that passion. When they walk across the stage, they either got it or they don't. And unfortunately for Jeb, he's in the shadow of his brother, and he will not make it, no matter how much W tries to help him.
So looking ahead, just as in closing, we've got obviously the South Carolina primary on the Republican side, which you've alluded to, and Donald Trump looks certainly very strong there. We've also got the Nevada caucuses on the Democrat side. I mean, what should us Brits that are looking at the election and watching it very closely, what should we be watching out for in those races and in moving ahead to Super Tuesday?
Well, you should be thinking this. You should be thinking the caucuses in Nevada are on the 20th. The Democratic primary is on the 27th in South Carolina. The Republican primary is on the 20th. So they're split up a little bit. Hillary is looking very strong when it comes to Super Tuesday. She's got latest polls have her way out. But, you know, it conflicts a bit, too. They've got her in 10 of the 12 states, mostly in the South, with double-digit leads. States like Alabama and Arkansas, Georgia, Louisiana, Michigan, Tennessee, Mississippi, Texas. I mean, watch Super Tuesday. That will be a great indicator. And then I was looking at a CNN poll today, which shows Hillary and Bernie tied in Nevada. And then nationally, it shows them she has 44% and he has 42. It is so changeable. And the African-American vote is key. And South Carolina will be the first state where that matters. Now, there's a generation gap. For some reason, the younger folks, the millennials, are interested in Bernie. He's two generations above them, but they still, or maybe three, if I may, but they still see a connection. They have a connection because he's offering them, as I said, revolutionary things that they never dreamed of having with Hillary, perhaps. And they can't relate to the Clintons. They don't remember the Clintons. If you're 25 years old, you don't remember who Bill Clinton was, except from what your mom or dad says, and you know maybe that's not such good stuff. So the Clintons are moving away, and you got two of them. I'm sorry, Bill and Hillary, and Bill is out there. Hillary Clinton has the older ladies. She has some of the black women, but those black women voters, who are substantially more voters, are African American women, especially in South Carolina, than the men are, and they are there for Hillary. But the younger ones and the younger folks and the millennials, they can't relate to her. She doesn't resonate with them. And if they get out the vote, we have a big thing here in America. We call it GOTV, get out the vote. If those millennials get out the vote, it can be their election, just as it was for that generation, similar generation, in 2008 when Obama was making that plea, yes, we can, and they believed him. and they wanted him, and in fact, he won. And he won twice.
John Christopher Buer, thanks very much.
A pleasure.
That was John Christopher Buer, their White House correspondent and political analyst in the US. So I'm joined to discuss some of the issues raised by Leo Barassi, fellow podcaster. Leo, welcome back to the show.
Hi, Karen.
So you listened to the conversation there with John Christopher, and what was your key takeaway? I mean, clearly there are two aspects going on in the last few days, the death of Justice Scalia and the presence of W on the campaign trail.
Yeah, so as John Christopher says, I think the Scalia death is big news. But how that then plays out in practice, what then happens, I just don't think we know. It's huge, but it's sort of unpredictable. You might say, well, this is great for Cruz because it allows him to sort of burnish his anti-democrat credentials. But as John Christopher says, Trump is essentially doing the same thing, so perhaps that negates that. There's been a suggestion.
They're in the Senate, though, aren't they, of course? Not just Cruz, but Rubio, too. So
sure.
Maybe they've got that.
Perhaps. So, you know, perhaps all you get from it really is this is just going to heighten partisanship. This plays quite well with the base. So it sort of it perhaps polarizes things a bit more for the primaries and then potentially makes things more difficult when it comes to the general for a candidate on either side to be able to appeal to moderates.
And I suppose one of the things that he mentioned was the fact that maybe Jeb Bush might struggle after all. I mean, what do you make of his campaign? It's been a bit insipid, hasn't it?
Insipid is possibly kind. It's been a terrible campaign. It's been really lackluster. But, you know, as John Christopher says, if you don't have that swing, then, you know, sort of what can you do with that? You know, Jeb, I think he's now reached a point where he makes the kind of mistake that some other candidates might make sometimes and people would just let it go. And really I'm thinking of this please clap moment where he was making a speech and then at the end of a rallying call there was silence and he sort of meekly says please clap. And it was just dreadful. I think other candidates you might sort of think, oh, that was bad. But the thing about Jeb, he's now in a place where it's the death spiral. You see that and you think that's just the kind of thing that exemplifies his campaign. And
so
it's hard to see you coming back from
well.
That. Exactly. It all just feels desperate. It doesn't really feel like he knows what he stands for, that he's doing anything exciting. And it sort of feels like he's flailing about. His only hope now that something catastrophic happens to Rubio or perhaps Cruz, it's a pretty long shot. There was a suggestion that on 538 that now he is staying in the campaign essentially to try and do as much damage as he can to Trump, not because he hopes he can win, but really just as a sort of aristocratic guardianship of politics.
I mean, one of the things I think us politicos maybe are guilty of is maybe being a bit too clever. And I think I've mentioned this on this podcast before, and John Christopher kind of alluded to it. And I think we've got a chart from pollster.com which shows the actual sort of average state of the race nationally with the GOP, which shows, I think we can see it here, Donald Trump miles ahead. Now, this is a kind of rolling average of several polls cobbled together, but you can see very clearly the trend is obvious. Donald Trump is around the 40% mark. Ted Cruz has picked up a little bit, but plateauing just shy of 20. But there's no obvious sort of establishment candidate really breaking through. And people sort of seem to assume that, well, Donald Trump will fade away or maybe the establishment will unify around somebody else. But I'm looking at this chart and yes, it's a state by state race, but it still shows you very clearly that the way that the Republican primary vote is thinking is that, you know, Donald Trump is going to take some moving, isn't he? I mean, are we just, you know, using wishful thinking to ignore the inevitable that he's going to be the nominee?
Well, I've been saying for a while that 35% was Trump's ceiling and he had a load of people who loved him and he couldn't really go beyond that. Well, now he's at about 40%, so perhaps I adjust that upwards. So it's true that if you look at second preferences, he does a bit worse than Rubio and Cruz. So if Jeb were to drop out, then a lot of those supporters look like they'd go to Rubio. But the truth is he doesn't do dreadfully. He still gets some second preferences. So if the field thins, it's not like everyone else, like Rubio and Cruz, are going to suddenly close the gap and it's going to be neck and neck between the three of them. You're right. Perhaps if something catastrophic happened to Cruz and all the others dropped out, then Rubio might be able to get into a very close race. But there's a lot of ifs there.
It would certainly be interesting, even if there were three candidates, there's no reason, in my opinion, to assume that, you know, that automatically that establishment candidate wins. But let's move on and let's move back closer to home. We've got our own election cycle coming up, of course, in May. And I want to talk a bit about the state of the parties as we sort of look towards that. Now, I've been looking at this chart here, which is I've been taking the poll ratings from ICM. I just picked a pollster at random. I deliberately didn't choose the most disastrous numbers for Labour, which would be with Comrades, who have changed their methodology since the polling disaster. But this looks at, and those listening will tweet it out as well, looks at ICM's poll rating for Labour for all the parties in February this year and also February in 2011, so this same stage of the last Parliament. And what we can see for those listening in is the Tories on 39, Labour on 32, Lib Dems 7, UKIP 11, Green Party 4. Now, when we look back to when Ed Miliband was sort of but 6 months in, the Tories are on 35, Labour 38, Lib Dems 18, UKIP 2, Greens 1. So the upshot of this being that the Tories are 7 points ahead now, whereas at this stage in the last Parliament, the Labour were ahead by varying amounts. It looks pretty bad for Labour, doesn't it? How do you assess the party's situation right now?
Kieran, these are terrible numbers. This is really bad for Labour. At this point in a cycle, coming up to a year after the last election, for the opposition not to be ahead is really bad. So I would be expecting an opposition that had a good chance of forming a government to be about 15 points ahead in about a year's time from now. Perhaps not just yet, but in the next year, Labour should have double-digit lead if it wants to be ahead. So it needs to turn a 7-point deficit into a 15-point lead. That's a huge challenge. Comparing as well how Labour are doing in the first 3 to 6 months of a new leader under Corbyn compared with how they did under every other post-war leader, and you get the same thing. This is the worst performance for Labour in the 3 to 6 month period under a new leader that it's had since the war. This is a really bad position that they're in.
And but at the same time, it seems that Jeremy Corbyn's position amongst the Labour Party membership is as strong as ever. It doesn't seem like a leadership challenge is coming anytime soon. So, I mean, what do Labour moderates do? He's got to ride it out, I suppose.
Well, you're absolutely right. I mean, the rules of the membership and the voting system make it enormously difficult. It's a challenge that perhaps Sanders isn't having to the same extent because he's got such a wider membership, so slightly different context. And in fact,
what do you make of that? Because, I mean, there is this comparison people make, isn't there, between Bernie Sanders and Jeremy Corbyn, and you know, they're both veteran left-wingers, so they're popular amongst young voters, or a certain kind of young voter at least, so it's understandable that people make that comparison, but I know you've been quite sceptical in the past, haven't you?
Yeah, well, it seems to me that Sanders has proved himself already to a much greater extent than Corbyn has done, in that he has appeals to a much wider electorate so far. I think he's still got to do a lot more. Corbyn really has only proved that he can win amongst in a territory of 400,000, 500,000 people in a selectorate of people who are quite like that. And he has failed to get the same bounce in poll rating that every previous Labour leader, other than, say, Michael Foot, who, incidentally, was still much ahead of Corbyn when he was 4 or 5 months into his leadership. Corbyn's doing fantastically. Ken Livingston came out this week and said that Labour were looking at changing the leadership voting rules to stop MPs being able to decide who's selected, which is only going to solidify Corbyn further, you would think.
I guess one of the arguments you could make for maybe Labour's position improving is if the EU referendum goes particularly badly for the Conservatives. Obviously, the issue of Europe has been a huge issue over time for the Conservative Party. There were some polls, there was one poll at least, with Comrades this week that showed the race narrowing in terms of whether the British people would vote to leave or to remain in the European Union. Now, I mean, how much sort of credence do we give that poll? Obviously, we don't want to look at one individual poll too much. But at the same time, the Prime Minister does seem to have been suffering from negative headlines and a perception that his deal isn't going particularly well. So what's your assessment of that race?
So this is the Comrades poll that has put Remain only 8 points ahead. And that compared with his previous lead from Comrades' previous poll of 18 points. Now, 8 points sounds pretty good. You might look at that in isolation and think, well, that's quite reassuring. But the point is, this is a phone poll, and phone polls have been showing much much bigger leads for Remain, whereas online polls have been putting it neck and neck or even slightly in favour of Leave. So on the face of it, it looks pretty bad for Remain, and you might even try and draw a direct link with the renegotiation and the terrible coverage that came for the Prime Minister after that. I think you and I know that you should always be a bit wary of attributing changes in polls to a specific news event. It's very easy to overread them. And in fact, after this Comrades poll came out, another one by Mori, the only other one that is using the phone methodology, also came out and showed pretty much the same number, a much bigger lead, well into the high double digits that it had had previously for Remain. So it might just be the case that this Comrades poll is a rogue poll, not Comrades' fault. These things just happen with random sampling. We don't really know yet. Perhaps some of the other polls might show similar movement. But at the moment, I'd be cautious about reading too much into it.
Is there anything in the underlying polling that maybe can point us to the direction of travel of this campaign? I'm thinking that, you know, the polls do show that immigration is the number one issue that people care about in terms of the renegotiation. Obviously, it's going to be very difficult for David Cameron to deliver to expectations on that. I mean, even right now, what he's trying to achieve, there's lots of pushback with certain countries in the European Union, in the Eastern Bloc, if you like. But at the same time, other aspects of polling do show that leaving the EU is seen as more risky than staying. So perhaps, actually, we've got this intangible sort of gut feel of maybe if the Prime Minister says we should stay and the business community says we should stay, I feel it's a little bit risky. You know, yes, I'm annoyed about immigration, but ultimately, you know, it feels to me that Remain has a lower bar to clear maybe in terms of winning, even if, you know, in reality, of course, it's a 50-50 race.
Yeah, I'll be pretty inclined to go along with that. So there was an interesting finding in that Comrades phone poll that we've just been talking about, that they asked what are the issues that are driving people's vote on the referendum, their intention to vote. And there were two things quite clearly at the top, control on immigration and control over laws. Now, both of those are clearly issues that belong to the Leave campaign. They're things that if you really want to leave the EU, the chances are you would see those as the two most important things that are influencing how you vote. The third, but some way down, was economic factors. And it seems to me that the Remain camp has already and is really going to continue to push very hard the staying in the EU is about economic stability. The fact that that number is relatively low can perhaps be read two ways. Either it's not as strong a card as they hope, or I would sort of incline this way, it just hasn't cut through yet. People aren't paying attention, but a bit like in the Scottish referendum, as it gets closer, they're just going to be hammering there, don't take the risk, this is dangerous, uncertain times, instability, risk, don't do it. And I just think that if even when people aren't thinking about economic factors, they're still either neck and neck or have a reasonable lead, depending on which polls you believe, then I think once economic stability starts being more talked about, then I think it's looking like it's swinging in their favour.
Ian Barassi, thanks very much. That's all we've got time for this week's episode of the PoliticalBetting.com Polling Matters podcast. Thanks again to Leo Barassi and my other guest, John Christopher Buer, for their time. Certainly lots to think about on the American presidential race. The candidates will be vying for that big momentum that they're after in Nevada and South Carolina, and then moving ahead to Super Tuesday. And with the EU referendum negotiations, David Cameron hopes to have a deal wrapped up soon. I'll be discussing that in more detail on our next podcast episode with UKIP MP Douglas Carswell. So stay tuned for that, and thanks for listening and watching. Do share with everybody. Let people know that the podcast is out there. It does help grow our audience. And in the meantime, we'll see you next week.